Hi, I'm Kat.
And I'm Emma.
If you love the Dead Parent Club podcast, you can help support its future using the Acast supporter feature.
Now, it's up to you how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So if you can and you want to, please do hit the link in the show description to support now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, you're listening to the DPC podcast, the podcast where we talk about all things Dead Parent, the good, the bad, and the banter, hosted by
Sam
and Kat.
Unfortunately, Kat isn't with us today. With the time zone changes, oh my God, it's been a nightmare. But whichever way the UK clocks went, the Aussie clocks went the opposite way. So it meant that we are now like 9 hours out from each other and are really struggling to find times that we can both speak at the same time. But fortunately for me, I could do this time today, and we are joined by the lovely Victoria. Aww. So we'll get straight in. Victoria, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself to start with?
Perfect, yeah. So thanks so much for having me. Big fan of the show. So I'm obviously Victoria. I'm 35. I live in Shropshire, UK. So I run a women's clay shooting club, which I know is like such a bizarre thing for people that aren't into clay shooting. So I set up my own business 8 years ago because I wanted to make it really easy for women to get into clay shooting. So women like me that are just from a really normal background. And I just wanted to bring women together and just bring them confidence. And I've got this real thing about, bringing women together.
How did you get into, were you shooting before? Like, were you into shooting before you started this?
Yeah, I was. So shooting's like, because it's such a closed off, well, it's perceived as like a closed off kind of industry. And people don't know much about it. So it's just very male dominated. And there's the stereotypes about the classic like white affluent male with a gun dog and a Land Rover. Mm-hmm. And I'm just this very normal girl from a very normal background. And it was just, I got into shooting and there were a few women that shot already and, you know, were really good. But it was just a bit like green, camo, grey, very like testosterone heavy, and I just thought we're missing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'm quite ballsy and confident, and I just thought for women that aren't as confident as me, like they'll just never get the joy out of this because I'll never get started because it's just so like man heavy. And while the men are all really nice, I just decided to set up a clay shooting and cake company, which are my two favorite things, and I've had massive success with it. Actually, I'm so proud of it.
Clay shooting and cake. How did you get the cake involved?
I took four girlfriends clay shooting and they just weren't up for it. They were like, oh my God, guns, no way. You know, the recoil of the gun, if I don't hold it right, will hurt me. So I was like, well, I'll fake one of my amazing Victoria sponges. You just come along, have a go. We'll have a group shooting lesson. And then, you know, at least you'll have tried it once if you don't like it. And we had the most amazing day. And I mentioned it on my Twitter because this was like 8 years ago, old school.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh my God, can my, you know, wife or girlfriend or whatever come to one of your shooting events? And I was a bit like, oh, I've got shooting events. Yeah, of course. And then I actually went to Western Australia for a month to see my sister in Perth. And I lay on a beach and I thought, actually, sod it. I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to start this events company. And I did.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was September 2011. And then it's been such a journey ever since. It has been really successful. It's taken me a long time to kind of, you know, appreciate that. But I kept burning out and I had no boundaries. I had no proper systems in place. I was experiencing this massive growth and I was just spending so much time just knackered on the sofa and just worn out and living on Red Bull and cereal bars. So I kept burning out and then my dad died, which I'll get on, obviously we'll get into, won't we? But I just thought when he died, what do I want out of life? And actually I want to go down an entirely different route. So I've written a book which it's going to be called From Burnout to Balance, I think, which is, it's going to be out next month, and I'm cutting it really fine.
Wow.
The title. And I'm training as a coach as well. And there's this real thing of like confidence and getting through self-doubt and just supporting women and just kind of like stepping into my best life. Like that's what I'm really trying to do. So it's a really exciting time.
I love that.
All this really incredible stuff that's just going on since my dad died. So my story is a little bit different, I think, in terms of my grief. But yeah, I can't wait to share all that with you. But yeah, so here I am.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, congratulations to you, first off.
Thanks. Sorry, it was a bit long-winded.
No, I love it because this is a total side note, but I love it when I hear women saying, I'm successful, or this thing that I'm doing is successful. Like, I love it so much.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and it's great to say it and to know it as well.
Amazing. I also think this is the perfect time to pivot into what, you know, obviously this is the Dead Parent Club podcast. Mm-hmm. So what is your dead parent story?
So mine was my dad, Carl, who was just, like everyone's dead parent, he was the most incredible man ever. He was really tall. He was really handsome. Like, all my friends' moms fancied him at school. And even when I was older, like, all my friends started like fancying him. He was just like, he's handsome.
Delf.
And he was about 6'5", and he had like jet black hair, and he just had the most kindest way about him. He was the kind of person that he made everyone feel like a someone. And he was hilariously funny, and he worked really hard. He worked in like factories for most of his life, and then he sold a house, and then not for a lot of money, but then he bought some little cottages and started property developing, which was really fun. And he worked incredibly hard his whole life, because I'm one of four sisters. Bless him, totally outnumbered.
Wow.
Yeah, so he kind of got to like live his dream out a bit, really. And we moved to the countryside, and he had this beautiful little cottage, and everything was just going really, really, really well for him. And like his girl, you know, us girls were doing really well. And then, then he got diagnosed. He lasted 5 years from diagnosis. And so 2012, he got diagnosed. And it was just like everyone. Oh, yeah, so with cancer, obviously. And with most people, it just came out of nowhere. And we kind of thought it would be all right, to be honest. He said he wasn't very well and just felt a bit weird, and he had bowel cancer, and he was just a bit like, oh, well, I've got cancer, but, you know, it would be all right. And we didn't really think anything of it at the time, and we just thought, oh, yeah, you know, he's caught it really early, so therefore he'll probably be all right. And he had an operation to remove some of the tumour from his bowel, which went really well, and, like, that was that. And we were like, oh, all right, it's fine, we'll just get on the rest of our lives. And then he went for his, I can't remember if it was a 3-month or 6-month checkup, or it might have been longer than that actually, but he went for a checkup, and it spread into his like lymph nodes, I think it was. And then it just went for it and just totally spread. Within a couple of years, he was ravaged by it. It was, yeah, like quite a difficult strain that like chemo wouldn't touch. So he had like all the usual, chemo, radiotherapy. And we tried him on everything in terms of treatment. In terms of like a vegan diet, we tried him on like cannabis oil. We even tried him just on cannabis, which is hilarious.
Oh my God. You're the first person we've had on that has tried to that extreme. Most of the time it's like just eating healthy, exercising.
We did everything. Like, we were just, people would say, have you tried like pine kernels? Have you tried him eating, like having 3 pints of carrot juice a day, and like all the fad like cancer beating diets on Google. I'm pretty sure we tried every single one, and he was so
good. Wow.
He was so good about it. We were like, Dad, we've got you some like CBD oil off the internet.
And he was just taking everything you were giving him.
Yeah, he was so good, because he just knew like he meant the absolute world to us. And
yeah,
and he was that kind of guy. Like, he was just so selfless and just so caring, and like, he just wanted everyone to be, not wanted everyone to be happy. He was just a very kind man with a big heart. And he just, yeah, he knew exactly how much he meant to us, because we meant that much back to him. So, aww. Yeah, so my sisters and I were all like, we've always felt like really privileged to have him as our dad, because we know that not everyone has a good dad. And he always kind of like nurtured us, and, you know, if a boy ever broke our heart, he'd be like, bloody hell, you know, his loss or whatever. And, you know, he's like, I'm my little bloody girl. Like, he was a little bit, he used to say bloody quite a lot. but yeah, he was just this beautiful man. And he was so willing to just, yeah, do what he had to do for his girls and for his family. And I bought my first house to be closer than him. to him because we moved away. And so we'd go over to his house like every single day, and we'd all just sit in bed with him, like towards the end, watching Escape to the Country and bringing him food and just like just having a laugh with him. And he really like laughed and made the best of it. And he was never a victim. My dad wasn't. And that's really taught me a lot in life, I think. Like he never felt sorry for himself. And I think it's totally fine to feel sorry for yourself, because I do quite a lot, but it's just something I really, really took from how he dealt with it, because he just got on with it. And that's just given me so much perspective, and I've taken so much from him dying and him facing cancer, you know, like all these incredible lessons.
Was he really ill towards the end?
Yeah, he started really going downhill in, I think it was December 2016. We all used to go to his consultant meetings with him. We'd all pile into this little
all four of you.
Yeah, and Mama.
But the doctors were like, right, we need to get some more chairs in.
No, it was hilarious, and his consultant was so good. He's like, oh, good to see you all again. And we'd all be sat on the floor. So they gave him 2 years to live in December 2016, and that was just like shattering. And it was from there it went downhill, really. So he went on chemo straight away, and we carried on with like the vegan diet, which he wasn't very keen about, and tried to get him off sugar as much as we can, like all the things. And then he had a tumour that grew. One of his lungs was entirely blocked off by this tumour, and he was coughing all the time, and he kept getting chest infections. And then we took it, 2016, we took him to Germany for some virotherapy. So we did a crowdfunding thing, and took him to this obscure clinic in Germany and paid thousands of pounds for him to have this treatment called Rigvir, which, to be honest, I don't know if you've heard of Rigvir. People have a lot of success with it, but with my dad, it was just too late. So it's basically they inject a virus into you. And this virus carries, like, I'm not scientific at all, but carries some kind of cell, something which seeks out the cancer, embeds in the cancer, and then basically blows the cell up. It's spelled R-I-G-V-I-R, if anyone wants to Google it. So
I'm definitely going to Google it.
We took him to Germany for that, to this, like, hilarious clinic, and we had, like, an amazing time. We were there for 2 weeks, and we had a bit of hope around that, and his cancer markers dropped, and his cough got better. And then it was the 2016... You've only got 2 years to live.
How did you find out about this treatment? Was it literally because you and your sisters were just like Googling stuff all the time? And you just came across this one and were like, right, we need to go to Germany.
Yeah, definitely. It was, we were very public about his illness, because I've got all these lovely members in my shooting club, and we'd post all these updates on Facebook, and people really got involved and really got behind us and shared the journey with us. And people would suggest stuff, but we'd just be on Google like all the time, and we'd like subscribe to like websites and like all sorts. We don't ever quit, me and my sisters or my mum and dad. Like, quitting's never an option, so we just fight till the bitter end, and that's what we did with him. And he just fought with us. It was amazing. So this tumor in his airway stopped him from breathing, and he was scared to death. He'd never say it, but we all knew it, that of just stopping breathing one day. So his consultant would occasionally take him into hospital every like 6 or 8 weeks and laser off some of this tumor, so some air could get into this lung, because he just couldn't breathe. And
wow.
So he had that done a few times, and it was great, and he could breathe and have a little bit of like better quality of life until it grew back. But then in April 2017, when was it, 2016? Anyway, they took him in for the operation. As usual, I went with him. And then they accidentally nicked the tumour, the bit of tumour they shouldn't have lasered, and the tumour started to bleed into his good lung. So they had to sedate him and to let this tumour clot. And we were in intensive care with him for 2 days. And he'd signed a DNR, and he was like, don't you dare resuscitate me. Because he was kind of ready to go, I think, by this point. He'd been through so much. Mm. And it was just like horrific. And I just can't ever remember like ever being so sad in my entire life, of just seeing like my dad sedated on this trolley in intensive care, all these like lights and, you know, all the beeping, and he had these two rods down his throat, like a ventilator, just seeing his chest like move up and down. I'm totally going to cry now. I cry a lot. Yeah, and just like this mechanical breathing, and we were all just there like holding his hand, and he'd come round a bit because my dad was so big and strong, And apart from the cancer, he was like a big, healthy man. So they'd given him all this like sedative, but he kept coming round from it. And obviously he had these two big like rods down his throat and he just kept panicking. And then they couldn't give him too much because they didn't want to kill him. But then they, yeah, it was just like horrendous. And then his pulse went down to 20 beats per minute. And you can just imagine, can't you, like the carnage of like all these alarms going off of all these monitors. And he signed a DNR.
I bet the sound of that was just horrible.
Yeah, it's still, in fact, our microwave, this is really funny, our microwave, when it stops, when it's like done its time, it will just keep beeping. And every now and then, I just think of my dad's like chest going up and down and this like
mechanical. Oh my God.
I need to get a new bloody microwave.
Oh, yeah, I just want to enjoy a chicken korma without having to think about this.
Yeah, that's it. So, yeah, this 20 beats per minute thing, like, oh God, me and my mum and my sisters, you can just imagine, can't you, like, the panic and the horror, and we just thought, God, he's going to die, like, in a bloody, you know, in a hospital, you know, with these, like, rods down his throat. And then we just, it was just like a miracle. We were just like, this is it. We're all, like, you know, bawling and, like, we're telling him we loved him. And then he just went back to normal. And his pulse went back up. And we were like, oh, my God. But he was okay. And then that night, they discharged him from intensive care, put him on a ward, and then moved him to a local hospital. And, he after a couple of days, he got his strength back and he was okay. So he went home. And when I say okay, he still had this terrible cough and he couldn't really get anywhere. And he was miserable, but, you know, doing his best to paint on a brave face.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was hard. And every single day we were going over there And then in June, so I run this massive shooting event once a year called National Ladies Shooting Day, and it's massive, and it's the most stressful time of my life. I'm just trying to get it all organised. And it was about a week before that, my mum rang me, so I only live about half an hour away, and she's like, you've got to come, your dad, I've never seen him like it. And I was like, oh, fuck. So I went over, and he's like hallucinating, and he's sweating, and he's in bed, and he's delirious, and we rang 111, 111, and we were like, I need an ambulance, like, you know, need someone to come out straight away. But my parents live in the middle of nowhere. They live in this little tiny village that's like half an hour from like anywhere. Yeah, probably like 40 minutes from the nearest like ambulance station. And it was just like, just panic. And we were like, he's going to die, like here, now. It's like horrendous. And he didn't. We had all these miracles, honestly. It was just a... Cancer is such a roller coaster, isn't it? Well, any kind of thing. Yeah. So it was like horrendous, and the sweat was pouring out of him, and he was trying to say stuff, and we couldn't hear him, and he was coughing, and he couldn't breathe, and then an ambulance finally came, and he just like picked himself up a bit, and he was having a conversation with them, and they,
oh my god,
and then they took him into hospital, and it turned out he had sepsis. And again, like he just plummeted again, and we just thought he was going to die, and that was it. And they were giving him all these like amazing like antibiotics. They said they called the antibiotics Domestos because they said that it was just so strong.
Oh my god, that's not what you want to hear.
I know, it's hilarious. So he's in this like end of life unit, which was amazing. This room with this little rose garden, and there's a sofa bed, and. And he was in the hospital for about 6 days, and he just lay in his pants because all this sweat, like he just sweated and sweated and sweated. And then a couple of days later, he was fine again.
Oh my goodness. I bet your emotions must have just been like out of control. Like,
it makes me feel stressed just thinking about it now. And, you know, I had this really stressful event coming up, and I was like, oh my God, you know, my dad could die. Like, it was 2 days to go. And I was like, if he dies, I just don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm trying to get my business sorted so that if I did need to totally step away from it, then I could. And, you know, if he did die, obviously I wasn't going to go to the event anyway, but it turned out that I did. Mm-hmm. And actually, we really made the most of the time in hospital. And when he was awake and he was talking, we'd like video him, like talking about like the old days and like funny stuff he'd done. And we, even though it was like the,
that's a great idea, the videoing in the hospital.
Yeah, and we always just really took like our family all really just take the piss out of each other, and there's always banter, and we'll always look for the good. The hospital said that he wasn't getting out of there alive. He just said, you know, prepare yourself, he's not going to get through the sepsis. He did.
Wow. How was he doing this? We all need his superpowers.
I really genuinely feel like he was a superhero, like honestly. he was just so determined and headstrong, and like his just outlook on life, it was just amazing, really. And I feel so privileged that I've had him as my dad. And I know I say it a lot, but just because of his like strength and like determination, and you know, he wasn't ready to go on either of those situations. And there were a few more times when he should have died, but he just kept going. And then he'd get up, and you know, a couple of days later, he'd be drinking tea, having a couple of biscuits, and we'd all be laughing together. And you know, he'd be out in his garden or in his man shed, and he was just incredible, so strong and resilient. And then in August 2017, he'd been a bit weird for a couple of days. So yeah, August, he kept being sick, which was like really distressing for him. And he kept having headaches and getting funny smells, like smelling like burnt toast and stuff. So his district nurse, who was amazing, sent him for a brain scan. And it turned out he had a 4-inch tumour in his cerebellum, I think it was, which is the base of your spine and where your spine meets your brain.
Wow.
I know. And we were just like, oh. And I think we all realised that because he always bounced back, we always just expected him to bounce back, even though he was kind of fading away. And so my sister Rosie, my younger sister, and I, we were on holiday at the time. My mum was like, just go away, you know, just go and have a bit of fun, you two. So we ummed and ahed about whether we'd go home, and we just thought, actually, you know, bugger it, we're going to have an amazing holiday. Dad wouldn't want us to be sad. We'll FaceTime them every day, and then went home. And by this time, they put him on steroids to slow the growth of the tumour. And I don't know if you know anyone that's been on steroids. Like, it was just horrific for him. It was just like, first of all, his face swelled up, and he hated that. And he was just like really tired, and he was like hallucinating, and he was really confused, and he couldn't stand up properly, and you know, his mobility had gone right down. I think it's like his body had like turned to jelly a little bit. So the steroids were keeping the tumour in check, but they were kind of like just messing up the rest of him.
Yeah, that's one thing that I definitely hadn't thought about when my dad was in his kind of like last weeks or whatever, like the drugs that they give them, like you say, it just has all these side effects that you don't even think about, and it completely just changes that person.
100%. Totally. So he'd been just getting worse and worse and worse, and we all knew the end was coming, and we were all starting to prepare ourselves. And I'm so grateful to this day that we had those amazing 5 years with him, because I know that some people's parents just drop dead and they don't get the closure, and nothing was left unsaid with my dad. And I know he was so proud of us all, and he got to see us all, apart from one sister, get married and, you know that we were okay. And I think that's such an honour, because some people, you know, maybe they've had an argument with their mum or dad, and then, you know, they've been hit by a bus, and there's all this like unresolved stuff they've got. So I don't really have any of that. And I'm really aware and really grateful of that.
Was he in the hospital at this point, sorry, or at the house?
Sorry, yeah, he was at home. He died at home, which is what he wanted. He was coherent, actually, and we were like, oh, hi, Dad, yeah, how's it going? And like, whatever, and sat on the bed and cup of tea and biscuits and stuff, as usual. And then he just started, like, just going more and more downhill, and the district nurse came, and we all agreed that it was time for him to go on syringe drivers, because he wanted to go on syringe, like he wanted, when he died, like he just planned everything. He was amazing. He said, when the time comes, just put me on these syringe drivers, and he, you know, would go to sleep and it would just all be really peaceful, because he suffered so much. Like, he really, really did. Mm-hmm. So district nurse came, and like, we all just kind of, you know, sat there on the bed, and we were playing like all his favourite songs on YouTube, and it was just never ending cups of tea. All we do in our family is just drink tea. And, you know, we'd all take it in turns to like, hold his hand. And it was just kind of like beautiful in like a really fucked up kind of way. Like, there was so much love in that room. My parents live in like it's like an almshouse. It's like really old, like 1600s cottage. It's tiny. And this tiny bedroom. And there were like me and my three sisters, my mum, my 89-year-old grandma, and then his sister, and then his brother and his wife. And there was about 10 of us in this tiny room. Just all just sat there chatting, and my dad's like in bed just dying, and we're all like, you know, making the best of it, and we're all talking about the good times. And occasionally one of us would just fall to absolute pieces and go outside, and like you just can't really believe it, can you, like when they're dying. It was just
no it's a very surreal experience. Like, I felt like I was in a film.
Yeah, it's, and I think that's how my grief is as well. It's like, one minute you think like, yeah, dad's dying, he can't go on anymore, he's like fought, look at the state of him, he can never come back from this, yeah, that's fine, you know, we knew he was dying. And the next minute you're like, oh my god, my dad's dying, I can't live without my dad. I knew my dad.
Yes, yeah.
So it's just like, yeah, definitely. It's like these waves, and that's how my grief has been, I think. This is hilarious, it's a total side note. But those 3 days that my dad was like actively dying for until he died, we drank. We got through a catering sized box of Yorkshire tea with my family.
That's amazing. I was waiting for that. I was wondering. I wonder how much tea. They
it was
got
literally.
Though.
I'm not even exaggerating. It was a 480 bag box of Yorkshire tea.
That is hilarious. So funny.
And then, so about 6 o'clock. So he died on a Monday. So this must have been Sunday by now. And about 6 o'clock at night, we had this district nurse who was amazing, and she was just there all day. So she'd gone, and then she kept coming back and like refilling his syringe drivers, because he was totally under by now, and we knew he wasn't coming back. And he had that death rattle, the secretions, you know, when they just really want them to clear their throat. And that was trauma, you know.
Yeah, that was one of the scariest things.
He came around from like all this like morphine and like whatever they were giving him to hold him under. It was like because he was so big and strong, he like fought through it, and he was trying to say something, and his voice, it was so bizarre. So we had like all this layer of like, I suppose it's phlegm, isn't it? And just like snot and like whatever it is, really thick rattle. And you could hear this like tiny voice like underneath that, and it's like the most bizarre thing. And he was trying to say something, and his eyes were open. And there was this like panic and like this mania in his eyes. And he tried to get out of bed, and it was the most distressing thing.
No way.
So
everyone's like, no, stay down, like, stay down.
It was just horrendous. And it was just me, my mum, and sisters at this point. And my brother-in-law was there actually. I think my husband might have been. But he was, because he was so big, it was like, and he just had this like strength to him. And we were just like, it was just sheer panic. We were just on our own. We didn't know what to do. You know, we needed to give him more drugs, but we couldn't. And it turned out we think he needed a wee. Because we he'd never had like a catheter. He must have done like when he was in hospital, but like he'd like, you know, he wasn't to the point of like wearing nappies or anything like that. And, you know, apart from the cancer, he was so strong. And it was just like fucking horrendous. Sorry if I offend anyone by the swearing, but the magnitude.
No, honestly, we swear so much on this. So I swear to your heart's content.
Just him trying to get out of bed, and like, we're like, just die, dad, just go, just let go, you know, just stop it. And we couldn't get hold of the district nurse, so we rang like this emergency number, and they're like, oh, sorry, we're doing the changeover at the moment, we can't get to you for another 4 hours. And it was just what the hell are we meant to do? What if my dad gets out of bed and falls over? Or like, what if he, you know, gets up, we can't stop him, and he falls down the stairs? Like, he's drugged up the eyeballs. Mm-hmm. And then all the time there's this horrible like kind of, sorry, that was really unattractive, but this horrible, like, that death rattle. And me and my mum and sisters, like, the panic and just how we felt. And it's like, who the hell do you ring? You can't ring an ambulance because I can't take him to hospital because he wanted to die at home in his bed, and they would have just taken him to hospital. He would have died on a trolley. And the district nurse couldn't come out. The emergency doctor, like, because it was Sunday night? Yeah, no, it was Monday by now. But it was this funny time at night. And it was just horrendous. And so I remember like ringing Macmillan nurses just in floods of tears, just like, I was just desperate. It was just full on desperation. And that was just the absolute worst ever point of my life. And I thought, God, it can't get any worse than this, surely. And thank God it didn't. But yeah.
Oh my gosh. I feel like we had a very similar situation with my dad, because I feel like he was similar to your dad in that, like, because he was so strong, and the nurses, you know, they don't expect these people to be able to like physically hold themselves up anymore, or to be even to be able to move themselves. So we had a very similar situation where we were all like, no, Ben, stay in the bed, Ben.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? And when you kind of And towards the end, were you kind of willing him to die and then just like let go or just us?
Oh, this is one thing that I honestly, when I speak to people that haven't been through this and I say it, they're like, wow, that's horrendous. But honestly, by the end, we were like, we were doing all those things, you know, like you read in the newspaper, like they played a certain song and they went and, oh, we said, you can go now. And he went, so we were all there. My mum was one side, I was the other, my sisters are in there. We're all like, right, come on, dad, you can go. It's fine. Honestly, like, just go. And we were like, what songs can we play? Like, trying to get him to just like, right, come on, pause.
Yeah,
that,
well, that was the thing. And we did exactly the same thing. And he loved that Terry Jack Season in the Sun song. And oh, since he's died, I've listened to it about a million times on YouTube. But we were playing that on the iPad, and because we just didn't want him to suffer anymore. Like, he'd had so much suffering, and we kept him going for so long. We're like, come on, Dad, don't give up. And he just gave and gave and gave and fought and fought and fought. And we just had nothing left to give. And we were like, do you know what? He's done everything he needs to do. We're all happy. Well, not happy, but like, we're all like well-rounded, you know, happy, you know, in our lives apart from him. Girls, and we'd all done well, got good jobs, etc. So he'd done everything he'd set out to do. So we were like, just die, Dad, please just die. And you know, yeah, and I'm sure people listening to this who haven't got lost a parent yet are probably thinking like, oh my God, you heartless bitch, Victoria, how could you will absolutely love to die? And it's like, well, actually, it's just I wanted his suffering to end because of, you know, how desperate it was, and it was just desperate. So that night, eventually, we had this really irritating, but lovely. Well, no, she wasn't lovely. She was really irritating. This district nurse that came along, and she almost disregarded my dad, and she just talked about herself the whole time. Me and my mum and sisters were like, who the fucking hell is this woman? Like, oh, you know, he's dying here. And like, you're just talking about what your son's had for his tea. And I know now that it was her just trying to, you know, keep us calm and like, you know, distract us a little bit. But we didn't want that. We just wanted her to help him and to like keep him under. There's a local hospice to where they live called St. Richard's Hospice in Worcester in the Midlands. And they had this like night carer lady. It was a free service they offered. And they sent this woman round who was just amazing. So it's basically so my mum could get some sleep. So it was about 11 o'clock. She came, we'd met her, had a chat, decided that we could trust her with our dad. And then we went home to get some sleep, and then literally, so it's about 11 o'clock, got into bed, and then my landline rang, and my mum said that half an hour after we'd got, no, not even half an hour, like some a short time after we'd gone, the carer came down and said, you better come up quick, his breathing's changed. And if people haven't lost a parent yet, or anyone, you'll know when someone is about to die, their breathing changes. And I think they call it Chain-Stokes breathing or something. It's like bizarre breathing anyway. And then my mum just lay with him and just cuddled him. And she just said he took his last breath in her arms, and she just cuddled him till he went cold. And that was that. And she just said, I think she slept with him for like the rest of the night. And then it's late. Oh God, sorry. I think just hearing the words that your mum cuddled your dad till he went cold is like the most distressing thing in the world. And this lovely lady, this nighttime carer lady, stayed with my mum till like 6 a.m. And then we all went over again. And he was just lying there in his bed. He kind of, one eye was a bit open, which was a bit, awkward. He always had this like lovely smile. And he just lay there and just like, because we'd spent so much time in that bedroom for the past 3 days. Well, for the past like, you know, years. It was just like, we just sat there, and in one way we were kind of relieved that he was gone, because it was just an end and he wasn't suffering, and you know, we could start to you know, just grieve, I guess. And then his mum came round, Grandma Phyllis, bless her, and then my auntie and my uncle and some cousins came, and we all just sat on his bed drinking tea again.
Someone do a tea run quick.
I know, God, they say where there's tea there's hope, don't they? And the undertaker couldn't come until 3 o'clock, so we all just sat there and we chatted to him still, and it was just kind of just weirdly beautiful in this really fucked up way again. It was like he was at home, it was a beautiful day, Oh yeah, the day before as well, because I live in the countryside. The view out of their bedroom windows is that beautiful field and like woods and trees and stuff. And I saw a deer in their garden, and I've never ever seen a deer in that part of the country where they live. And my sister saw a butterfly, and yeah, so we kind of like knew he was going to die. It was like this weird sign.
Did you realise at the time that they were sad? Because I'm not sure if I ever realised at the time, like when things were happening, that it was a sign. But then you like you look back and you're like, oh, like duh.
yeah, this little, it was a muntjac, a little deer, just stood in the garden like looking up. I was like, oh my god. Yeah, at the time I was like, oh look, it's a deer. But now I'm just like, fucking hell, that's definitely a sign. And to see a butterfly in October as well. So the undertaker came, and it was actually hilarious. So my dad had planned his own funeral. He had one of his funeral plans, and we knew exactly what he wanted. And the most handsome undertaker you've ever seen came.
Oh, hello.
He's like this Irish guy of this amazing Irish accent and these like bright blue eyes and jet black hair. And he was like,
oh my god.
And my sisters were all like, oh, hello. And the husbands were like, all right, you girls. And we were just like, thanks, Dad. Thanks so much for finding us the most handsome, lovely Irish undertaker. It was like a thanks, Dad. And we could just all imagine him saying, like, oh, yeah, thought you'd like that.
That is amazing.
So obviously the undertaker came and they took him away. And we all actually, like, all the family had come by then. And then as they took his body out, which took some doing because he was so big and their stairway was really tight. There's like, you have to go around a corner, and it took them a while and a few bangs, I think. But as they brought his body out and put it into this van thing, we were like clapping and singing like, for he's a jolly good fellow.
Oh.
It just seemed right. And it was all just like done properly. It's like he wanted to die at home in bed, surrounded by, you know, the people that loved him most. And I think in terms of like a death, apart from like the desperation with the, you know, him coming around and that district nurse woman that wasn't very nice, it was like you couldn't ask for a better death. Like people die in trolleys in hospital corridors on their own, don't they? And
yeah, it's like a dream death.
Yeah, that's as much as you can have a dream death.
Yeah.
So, you know, went to see him at the Chapel of Rest and replanned his funeral, and his funeral was just incredible. So where they lived, in this almshouse at this like country estate, and there's this little tiny church attached to the stately home where they live. And we had all the pews facing inwards. So his coffin was in the middle of this little church and we're all facing his coffin. And it was really like informal, and the local vicar was just absolutely hilarious, and he was a bit sweary and really funny, and he loved my dad. My dad loved him, and he did such a great service, and we all took it in turns of standing up with that, you know, at the head of his coffin and just recounting like all the really funny times, and we're all just like laughing and crying. And my four of my cousins, and was it four of my cousins? Yeah, a couple of my cousins and like the husbands like pulled bed and like carried his coffin, and it was just bizarre. Like me and my mum and sisters just held, we're all like linked arms walking behind the coffin, and then we turned round and there was just like 30 odd like family members, and there was just this massive sense of pride. And we were so proud of him. We were so proud to have like had him in our family, and we were just so proud how like dignified and funny and caring and like all these things. And we were just so proud that we were going to give him the best possible send off. And it was amazing. As much as burying your dad can be, like, we did a bloody good job.
Yeah.
And then my dad obviously liked cake and biscuits. So his funeral, we had the wake. We did like a Great British Bake Off wake.
No way.
So we did it at this local venue, and we decked it out like a village fete with like bunting. Oh, you must think my family's really strict.
This is phenomenal. The more funerals I hear about, the more I'm like, this is amazing. Like there seems to be all these rules and like funeral like etiquette and stuff you should do, and it's like, do you know what,
we had a party with his life. Totally, he didn't want any black. He was just like, I want you to cry, you know, cry a little bit, but I don't want you to like mope around after me. You've got to live your life. And so we got all this champagne, everyone bought a cake, and it was like a village fete, and we had like a slideshow going of him and like all these pictures in frames, and we all just got really pissed and then went home and had fish and chips. And then, I don't know, I knew from that point when I was just sat next to his lifeless body the day after he died, that my life would never be the same again. And it's so weird that now I've just, it's like I've cut away what doesn't matter to me. It's like I thought, you know, I'm not going to let my dad die in vain. And, you know, I'm not going to just, obviously I did fall apart, and obviously I still haven't, I don't think you'll ever get over losing a parent. So, you know, sometimes I cry a lot. Sometimes I don't cry for like weeks on end, but I just thought, I'm just going to take the good from it and just kind of use it as like rocket fuel, I guess, to like lead a life that he'd want me to live, but actually that I could live. Instead of like, you know, I just stopped like giving a shit about what people think. I stopped, you know, pandering to people. I stopped saying yes to people that I didn't want to say yes to. And then I just thought, like, what really, really matters to me in life? You know, I'm so lucky in that I've got all my limbs. I'm like disease free. I'm, you know, I've got my eyesight. I've got my senses, and, you know, I've got an amazing family. And it's like, why am I fucking about so much with my life? And why am I, you know, why am I working so much? And so I started, this is a bit I didn't tell you actually, I've started doing a gratitude journal like a year or two before he died. So
we love a bit of journaling and a bit of writing.
All over it.
Preach.
Yeah. So that's how I got through the first couple of days after like losing him and burying him. I was just journaling, and I just kept reaffirming like how lucky I was to have such a great dad, and how I, you know, he wants me to be happy. He doesn't want me to, you know, shrink away and just into like a pit of despair for like however long. He wants me up and out there and like just being this, like, you know, this amazing little girl that he raised. Like,
how did you know like so soon after, how did you know that is what you needed to do? Because it probably took me a good 2 years before I was like, right, you need to start practicing gratitude. I would not have known in the depths of, you know, straight after losing my dad, to go and do that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think because I'd been doing it for like a year or two anyway, it was a big part of my life, and my mindset and my perspective started to shift anyway. So I was like, you know, in the hospital and like intensive care, I was like actively looking for the good instead of not. So I felt like I'd been on this journey and everything was leading me up to my dad dying. So, you know, this woman came into my life, Pip, who actually died of cancer as well last year, that helped me with my emails. And like, I got into this like mindset stuff, and, you know, people would step in and help me with my shooting events. And looking back, it was like just this path unfolding of like clearing the decks to get me to this point of losing my dad. And now it's just like, just totally changed my life. And in a really fucked up kind of way, I'm not grateful he's died at all, but I'm grateful that I've been through all this, because now I feel, you know, if you lose your bloody dad, it's like you can do anything if you can get through that, I think.
Yeah, you're like, it always gives you almost like a reference point to put everything back into perspective. Mm. And it's like, because I remember literally saying to people, I don't know, this was before we knew my dad was terminal, I was saying, I physically don't know if I could live without my dad. Yeah. I was like, I cannot live without my dad. And then when you realise that you can, you're like, wow.
Yeah, the time, I honestly just could not see life past losing my dad. I knew he was going to die. I was really realistic about it. But I just thought, how the fucking hell, like, what? I can't live without him. He's everything to me. Yeah. I speak to him on the phone every day. I see him every day. You know, his, like, praise means so much to me. And every time there's something about my car or something breaks, I ring him and I rely on him. And
gosh, yeah. Dude, that's been, like, the worst thing for me. I'm like, I haven't got a handyman to help me with my, like, adult stuff now. Help.
Yeah, he just had, like, dads just have, like, infinite wisdom about things, don't they, that we just don't know about.
Yeah.
I really noticed that when he'd gone. And I was like, oh, damn, my car's making a funny noise. Like, oh, I'll bring my dad. Oh, my God.
Exactly, like cars, boilers, DIY.
Yeah, all that. Anything in the garden. Yeah, so I suppose, yeah, I've just been on this journey, and I just felt like it was all just meant to be, and it all happened how it was meant to, and this valuable perspective. And yeah, and I don't really feel like he's left me. I don't know if you feel like that, but I quite often feel like I can see something out the corner of my eye. It's not necessarily him, but it just makes me feel like he's close to me. And because I'm quite spiritual and, like, you know, I definitely believe in, like, spirit and, you know, things like that. Yeah, I just still feel his love, and that just makes me feel really strong, even though I'm just really crying. But
I know, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Like, I know if Kat was here, she'd be saying, because she often feels like her mum is still with her.
Yeah, that's
I just often don't even, it's not that I forget that he's dead, because I know that he's not alive anymore, but I kind of still think that he's alive.
Yeah, totally.
Even though I know he's not, I literally can't explain it.
I know what you mean, totally. Yeah, I feel like I still tell him stuff as well. And I've got this table in my lounge. I'll put the picture on my Instagram or something. But it's like this little half moon table. And I've got all these pictures of him in frames, like him on my wedding day and like him at my engagement party. And then I've got some fairy lights and I light a candle for him every day. And and I light his candle in the morning. I'm like, oh, morning, Dad. I'm like, I'm going to have a great day today. And I kind of like tell him stuff. And I'm like, I tell him about like how I've been getting on, like writing my book, and I'm like, oh, I've written about this and this about you in it, and you know, or like, you know, fallen out with, you know, well, not fallen out with anyone, but you know, I'll like tell him about things that are on my mind, and I find just like talking it out loud to his photo just really helps me.
No, I was going to ask about writing about him in the book. Have you found that like therapeutic?
Massively. Yeah, it was amazing because I feel like you can just write from your heart. And I feel like I'm a bit more eloquent when I write as opposed to when I speak. And yeah, and just the whole thing of like putting pen to paper and just talking about him, like it just helps so much. Like it really does.
Yeah. Did you have like, with it, Pete, apart from your sisters and things, or I suppose they might have been the people, like the people that you spoke to at the time, kind of like in those first months after he died, like, did you have a great support network within your family and your friends?
Yeah, I'm really lucky in that I've got a massive support network, actually, because of my shooting club. So I've got all these really close friends and like members and people that came along for the journey. And then obviously I'm really close to my sisters and like my best friend and like family members and stuff. So yeah, and everyone loved my dad. I've never in my life met anyone that didn't like him. And so everyone wanted to talk about him. And I think that's the thing with grief, isn't it? You just want to keep, it's like you want to keep them alive by keep talking about them. And
yeah.
And so it was amazing. And I'm so, like, again, I'm so bloody lucky to have all that and to have all those people that like shared their experience. And they're like, look, you know, my husband died or my child or my parent or whatever died. And you think like, shit, actually, you know, you look at their Facebook or their Instagram and actually, you know, they're having a great time on holiday or they've got a new job and they're thriving. And because I felt like I couldn't see past him dying, and I just thought, you know, a part of me would die, it would all just go to shit, and just sat at home, you know, eating ice cream out of the tub in my pajamas. I did do that for a while, but I really drew on inspiration of people that had reached out to me and said they'd lost someone, but actually, you know, a couple of years down the line, it does get easier, and it does get easier. And but I really feel like I've turned my grief on its head, and like I'm using it for good. And yeah, I've just let go of a lot of stuff that I just didn't want to do, and I've just stopped being so bothered about things. Like if someone said something to me that would, I don't know, just like get my back up a bit, I just think, that's just someone projecting onto me, and actually my happiness and, you know, keeping my mood high is more important to me than being right or, you know, really caring what other people think. Or yeah, so it's taught me so much about myself, grief has, and I feel kind of privileged in a weird way.
You do. You always feel like, well, thank you, like thankful that you've. I think it's because it's the knowledge that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
that the worst thing that you thought could ever happen has happened and you are still like fine. 100%. Like obviously not, no one ever is 100% like themselves or whatever. And you never, like we say, like you never get over it, but you can actually still live a normal life. And I think that's such a good point you made around like looking up to other people that had been through it. I think there's such a huge thing in like grief role models, like just even just like everyday people that when, because me and Kat were both like at university at the time and we'd all of a sudden found out about, because you also, you never, you don't know about all these people before your parent dies.
You feel like you're the only one, don't you, that, you know, you can't that other people can know what you're going through, but you do.
Exactly. And it's like as soon as they die, all these people reach out and you're like, oh, but you're fine now.
Yeah.
You know, like, but how are you walking every day? How are you going to the shops and living in life?
That's it, yeah. It's like, I feel like, yeah, my grief, it's like my life is my legacy to my dad. I think that's how I deal with it. And I don't know, you know, that won't be the right way for everyone, but I just want to keep, I made my dad so proud and I'm so lucky that I did. Because, you know, I started this business and he'd always had like his factory jobs and, you know, worked these like horrific jobs and hours for low pay. And he really like admired my spirit and the fact that I'd go out there and, you know, make shit happen. And it's like my life now, in a kind of weird kind of way, part of it is like I'm still striving to make him proud. So I'm still pushing myself every day to live this amazing life. And I think step into the potential that, you know, when you're a baby and your parents, the kind of like hopes and aspirations and what they want for you. It's like, I want all that he wanted for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I know what you mean. It definitely makes you think more. I don't know why you almost want to make them more proud when they're not here than when they were. I think it's because you can almost explain yourself to them when they're still here. Whereas I'm like, I literally have no excuse now. So.
Yeah, that's it. But there've just been, yeah, so many lessons and just things that I've realised and, you know, insights and, you know.
What was the most kind of helpful thing that someone said to you after the fact or did for you that you thought, yeah, that's really helpful? Or did you not
have
that? That's
such a good question. I can't really think of anything, to be honest, but my journaling and just writing like 10 things a day that I was grateful for about him, that helped me come to terms with it, because the focus was on, instead of loss, it was like I kept the focus on love and how grateful I was to have had such a great dad. And, you know, as opposed to,
oh, I love that the focus on love.
Yeah, because, you know, some people's dads are just bastards. You know, they're really like absolutely, you know, what, for whatever reason, some dads and moms just aren't very nice. And, you know, I know this lady and her mom has always been very controlling and manipulative, and she'll just never make her mom happy. And her mom's like 86 and she's still got this control over her. And I just think, like, you know, and, you know, obviously I don't know her story, so I don't know why she's like that. But you just think people have got all these issues with their parents. And And I'm just so grateful that I didn't have that. And I had, you know, I feel like the price I paid for having such a great dad was having him for just a shorter time than most other people, because he was 61 when he died. Yeah. Equally, you know, my friend's dad died when he was 40-something. So I feel like, yeah, and actually this is really bad as well. So he died 30th of October. I went to America in the January with a friend on a work trip. Went to Vegas and I just thought I needed to get away, get over it, go to LA as well and just live my best life and, you know, just get away from like the winter and death and grief and, you know, just have a bit of sunshine.
Yeah.
Had a really good couple of weeks, only had like a couple of like major panic crying sessions, which I thought was really good.
That's a win.
And no really embarrassing ones in front of, you know, like important people at this industry event I went to. Although I wouldn't have cared because, you know, grief is love, isn't it, I think?
Oh, I love that, yeah.
So we got home, I think it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, my uncle rang to say that my grandma had been taken to hospital and she was dying, she had lung cancer. So it was like, oh God, like how much can life throw at you? And they were going to put her on syringe drivers. But then again, she just came back and she was laughing and joking and eating like jelly and ice cream on the ward like after a couple of days.
What is in your family's DNA? You need to extract that shit and get it sold.
That's it. Knock us down. We'll get back up. Just keep getting back up. So my grandma was in a hospital that was probably about 50 miles from where I lived. So I just launched my new membership in February 2018. And it was, again, a really busy time. I was trying to make sense of my grief with my dad, but keep this focus on love and, you know, get his gravestone sorted and just, you know, keep talking about my dad. And it took my grandma, bless her, 2 months to die. And like all these like hospital trips every day, which obviously, you know, I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying it was like, it was tiring being in the car for like a couple of hours a day. And just being at hospital with someone is exhausting. And you never drink enough and you just eat the crap food at the vending machines.
Oh,
and...
yeah, I ate so much shit.
So they eventually put her into a care home and then she died. And that was tragic. In fact, we scattered her ashes on Mother's Day, which was beautiful. We got covered in ash, which was just hilarious. The most hilarious, funny woman ever. So we thought that was quite apt that she died on April Fool's Day.
I want to say that's amazing.
No, we were grateful. We thought of all the days. Yeah, dying April Fool's Day. So that was like lovely. And then my friend Pip, that kind of saved my business really when my dad was in intensive care, and along with a few other women as well that kind of like kept it all going. So she had cancer and that spread and she started going downhill, and she died the day before my dad's birthday in 2018. So that was like, Pip just did so much for me, and you know, that was tragic. And she'd got a daughter and a grandson and a son and a granddaughter and a family. And it just wakes it all back up, and you just think, like, you know, this poor family, and you just want to help them, and you can't, and it's like they're on this journey on their own now, and they've got to find their new normal, and it just kind of just keeps bringing it back up. And then in September, so Pip died August, Dad died the October before, Gran in April. In August, my birthday is the 29th of August, and my husband and I saved up and we went to Barbados, and we were like, we're going to have this amazing holiday, it'll be awesome. And we've been trying for a baby for about a year.
Yeah.
And I had like this implant removed from my, in fact it's longer than that because my dad was alive and I had it removed, and then finally got pregnant in Barbados, which was like amazing, and we were like really chuffed, and you know, it was all brilliant. And then the day the royal baby was announced, I had a fucking miscarriage. And it's just like, I could
just anything else, world. Yeah. Anything else.
And yeah, and we've been trying ever since. We haven't had any luck yet, but I'm sure we will soon. And
how did you come back from that at the time? Because I can just imagine that must have been kind of just all consuming, like the way that you felt.
Yeah.
How did you, I mean, it's a big question, right? But
yeah.
What were the steps you took to get yourself back from that?
It was this kind of duty to my dad to live my best life. And I swear to God, it's just journaling. Every day I have like this morning routine, which I set my intentions. I list 10 things I'm grateful for. I'll set some like affirmations and I'll just journal through my thoughts. And I just thought, and I reframe a lot of stuff as well. And, you know, Pip was just an angel that came into my life when I really, really needed her. And she was just amazing. And, you know, it was like, it was her time to go. So I couldn't feel bad about that. And she was really sick and she was in this hospice for a while. And my grandma, she was like 86 and she was old and she couldn't get out of bed. And it was like, it was the best thing. And the miscarriage, it was like, there was something really tragic about like feeling your body change and then just like wither back to what it was before. That was difficult. But I just thought, well, actually, at least, you know, it is really sad. And I, you know, if I'd have gone full term, then I'd be like 9 months pregnant now. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, actually, we've been trying for like a year or whatever, and it just shows that my body works, and it, you know, I can get pregnant. So even though it's taken us a bit longer, but everything I believe has just been down to like my mindset and my outlook. And I could have fallen apart, and I could have, you know, just been a victim and stuff, which would have been fine. But I just, yeah, it's really important to me that, you know, while I'm healthy, while I'm well, while, you know, I just think that anything can happen tomorrow. We just can't plan or predict anything. And, you know, I could get hit by a bus or I could get a life-changing diagnosis. So, like, I'm here to just make the fucking most of every day because it could all change tomorrow and I don't want to have any regrets. And I think that's what's really carried me through. It's like just keeping this really firm perspective of how lucky I am, you know, what I can take, what I can learn from situations, and just keeping my mindset like really like focused and forward and positive. And it's changed my life. It totally has. And now I am grateful for everything that's happened. You know, I'd turn back the clock if I could. And, you know, I'd do anything to have my dad or, you know, Pip or my grandma back and to be a mum. But it just is what it is. And I'm grateful for this woman that I've become as a result of it, if that makes sense.
I am so in awe of that perspective that you have.
Thank you.
It's amazing, and I actually feel so inspired. I'm like, I want to go home and I want to start journaling, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that.
Oh, yeah, and I just think like we've got one life, and it's so easy to get bogged down with what people are doing on Instagram. Someone said something bad about you, or you know, you're stuck in this shit job, or your boyfriend's a bit of an asshole, or whatever it is. It's like we've got to change it. We've got to change what we don't like, and we've got to live our best lives because we could get run over tomorrow. Or, you know, something could fall out of the sky and like kill us or whatever. And that's not
exactly
me. And that's not me being paranoid of dying, because when I die, I know I get to see my dad again. But it's like, I just feel like we're here for a reason, and we're just lucky that we have options, and that we're not, you know, lying in an end of life unit or like a palliative care bed or whatever, just taking our last breaths. It's like, we are fucking here. We've got to make the most of it. That's my outlook.
That is phenomenal.
And I know that not everyone will be like me, and it's fine that people aren't like me, and we all have our own different ways of dealing with grief. But yeah, I really believe that had my dad not died, then I would probably be on my way to living like a mediocre life. And he didn't work as hard as he worked for me to be mediocre, and that's like fucking massive to me.
Yeah,
so that's me.
I really love that. Do you have any like kind of parting advice? So, because I was going to ask how it's changed the way you go about life, but you've answered that, and it's honestly amazing. Like I appreciate what you say when you said not everyone's going to be like me. Yeah. So like, I love what you said when you said, look, not everyone's going to be like me, and that's fine. And that's definitely something that I am like accepting now, that like, look, Sam, the way that you feel and deal with your grief is not the way that everyone else does. Like, I always knew there was no rule book, but you can't help but think like, why don't you feel the way that I do? Look, I feel happy and blah, blah, why don't you? And it's like, you have to accept that everyone goes through like different stages as well.
Yeah, totally. I feel like grief is such a personal thing. And because, you know, my granddad died 5 years ago, but he was like 93, and that was sad for a couple of weeks. But, you know, again, we knew he was going to die. So I hadn't really experienced massive grief. But I think a lot of it is to do with how a person died. You know, if there's any notice or not, I think that, I don't know, because we had all this runway and we knew who was going to die. But I think if you've got anything unresolved with that person as well, I think that must play on your mind. So say for instance.
Yeah, we always have, like, we always have discussions around, like, kind of the pros and cons of, like, when you lose a parent.
Because, yeah, and again, you know, I don't know what that feels like. So I was so lucky with my dad, and he was proud, and I, you know, didn't have anything left unsaid. So I think that's a factor. And I think it's, you've just got to take all the time that you need. You've got to cry as much as you possibly can, because I think, you know, crying is love, and I don't think you'll ever cry it all out. And I think just be prepared for it to like sideline you at times. Like, I'll just be driving along and, you know, I'll see something or something will just set me off, and I'll just be like, oh my God, Dad, like, how are you here? Or, you know, there'll be times where you just feel like you need them, and you're like, I just fucking need you, like, now, and they're not coming. And and I think you just got to roll with the punches. You've just got to honour how you feel. You've got to have a good support network around you, and you've got to have people to talk to. Otherwise, I just think grief just manifests in a bad way, and you know, that's where it makes it harder for you to move forward with your life if you don't have an avenue to kind of talk and stuff, which is why it's so important about what you do. And what else? Yeah, and I think you've just got to take from it what you can. Like, I'm so lucky with my perspective. And if you can't see that, or you can't see any perspective or any good that's come from losing a parent, then I suppose I just urge you to just look a little bit deeper. And I just journal it out totally. I just try and make sense of, you know, there's got to be one good thing that's come from losing a parent. You know, I've had loads and loads of, you know, I've changed my life and my business. I've written this book and I've done all, you know, all these amazing things and keep going on holiday more than I used to. But I've just got...
Treat yourself.
Yeah, definitely treat yourself. And yeah, just try and find one little kind of glimmer of hope or one little spark of something that you can nurture and build on. And just, I find just keep telling myself like every day how lucky I am, how grateful I am, and just really believe that. And yeah, just cry when you need to, lean on other people, you know, keep listening to your podcast and just looking for that inspiration. And yeah, just talk to people because people want to help. That's the thing. And you just never know who you're helping by telling your story, I don't think.
I definitely agree and appreciate that last sentiment as well. Like, before we started this podcast, we were kind of like, it was almost selfish because we were like, well, we want to talk about our parents. Yeah. And we want to, you know, hear from other people that have as well. And just the amount of people that, I mean, you probably had this on Instagram and stuff, like the amount of people that are just looking for ways to reach out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So it's just amazing. And I love giving, like, having this platform that people can come and just speak about their parents.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's what you've done is just amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on your podcast. Like,
we've paid her to say this.
But I found your podcast and I was just like, oh my God, these girls. And I just felt like, even though I didn't know who you were or anything, I just thought, you're my people. And I just thought, yes,
yes.
Get it? Because you just think that people don't get you. And it's like, uh-huh. And people worry sometimes, you know, people that are grieving, other people might think, oh, you know, she might cry, or I don't know how to deal with her, or like, oh, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah, that's like one of the big things, right? They're like, oh, I didn't want to ask because I didn't want to upset you.
It's like, fucking hell, I know he's dead. It's not like I've forgotten.
Yeah, it's like, oh wait, you just reminded me that my dad died. Yeah,
that's it. And actually, I love it when people hear me out and let me talk about him. And I'm sure you feel the same as well. And, you know,
yeah.
I think if anyone listening hasn't lost someone, you know, they just happen to be listening, then if you know someone that has lost a parent or anyone else, ask them about them. You know, it's the biggest mm-hmm. gift you can give them, I think, just because it helps keep their memory alive and to remember the good. And that's what it's all about for me, remembering the good. Drop the mic.
Yes, mic drop. See ya.
Yeah, always remember the good, because I think that's what will get you through the dark times. And even when you can't think of any good at all, just keep on digging, because you will find someone you look, and just be open to it.
I really love, I feel so inspired.
Oh, thanks. I'm chuffed.
I am so, I'm literally, honestly, as soon as I get home, I am going to be like writing down all my goals, my intentions,
everything. And if you don't do it for your dad, because all dads want their little girls and their little boys to just be happy and lead these amazing lives and be successful and to do whatever they want to do. And yeah, use it as motivation.
So good.
Yeah, I think just look after yourself, keep the memories going, do whatever you need to do. And just go out there and just fucking live your best life. And just things that don't matter, just get rid of them, cut them away. If you are really unhappy in your job or relationship or whatever, and you can't change it immediately, just take little steps every single day to just make you feel better or change your focus. Or yeah, just we are so lucky in that, you know, we're still alive. We haven't got a disease, most of us. You know, our arms and legs work and, you know, like all the things that I've talked about. Like, we've got to make the most of that because, it, you know, we're going to die. So you might as well just get on with it. Stop caring about what other people think. Like, just do it.
Preach, sister.
Sorry.
Oh, no, don't be sorry. That's phenomenal. Oh, well, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. It's been, honestly, it's been great to talk about my Carl Heinz Lacks.
Yay.
Yeah.
Oh.
And what a great day he was.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's DPC podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have and have found some comfort in the stories that you've heard today.
If you've resonated with anything we've said, have any questions or want to get involved, please do contact us. We're on Instagram. It's at DPC Podcast. You can email us on dpcpodcast@hotmail.com, or we have a contact form on our website, www.dpcpodcast.co.uk.
We have a whole bunch of resources over on our website. More information about dealing with grief, losing a parent, and professionals to contact if you should need it.
Because as Kat so eloquently said in our first podcast, we're not providing healthcare, we're just chatting shit.
If you think this podcast could help someone, then we would love for you to share it.
We upload new podcasts every week, so make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out.
Loads of love
from Sam
and Kat.
See you next Tuesday.
Nailed it.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.